Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Valiant Sunday episode, and today I'm joined by the writer of a new project that's coming out from Valiant. It has me very excited. I got a chance to read the first issue already. It's Killers, and I'm joined by writer B. Clay Moore. Clay, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. Like I said, I really enjoyed the first issue. I think it was spectacular, and I think you've really got something special here, and I hope a lot of the Valiant fans and non-Valiant fans even pick it up, because it's I thought it was very new reader friendly as well.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think it's definitely intended to be a good jumping on point for people, or whether people are tied into the Valiant universe already or not, it should. It moves pretty quickly and introduces new characters, so it should work pretty well for people.
Yeah, and I want to get more into the specifics of Killers in a minute, but I always have to ask everybody when they come on for the first time sort of about their secret origin. kind of about your history. Did you grow up reading comics, and then kind of the decision to become a creator, and maybe some of your previous work that our listeners may be familiar with?
I grew up from about fourth grade, I guess. I was reading comics, actually maybe earlier than that, through the very early 80s, and I moved around a lot as a kid, and just kind of always hung on to comics and music as things that I could, I always knew would be there when I moved to a new place or what have you. So as a kid, I had a group of friends who read comics, and then through most of high school and college, I didn't really know anybody who read them but myself. But like a lot of creators, I started off drawing and wanted to be an artist. And at some point I realized I didn't have discipline. I mean, I was always the kid who could draw well in class, but then there's a certain point where some people really dial in and focus. And I realized, man, I probably don't have the discipline to be as good as I need to be. So I did a comic strip that I wrote and drew in college. And then after college, I was working in sales, and I had done some fanzines and some stuff, and I'd gotten to know a few people kind of on the fringes of the industry. And there was a writer named Jay Torres, who was a friend of mine, who at the time had done a book at Slave Labor Graphics and had just gotten something picked up by Oni Press. And then following that, he did an Image book. And literally, I was complaining about what I was doing, and he was like, well, why don't you just write comics? which sounds easy, but he actually had a book called Love and Tights that he just had approved at Slave Labor Graphics, which was an anthology, like a superhero romance anthology. And he was bringing in a bunch of different independent creators and what have you. Anyway, he invited me to, try out or participate. I think he might've actually thought I would draw something initially, but long story short, I got involved with that with Jay. I ended up editing the book with him, wrote my first few stories that were published there, got to know a lot of people in the industry through conventions and figured out, it was actually a great learning experience, because most of the work had to be done by us, more specifically by me. So I kind of figured out how to put books together and how to format them and how to deal with editorial and even how to write solicitation copy. And so anyway, at that point I knew that the next thing I wanted to do would be my own creation. And along with an artist named Stephen Griffin from Australia, I put together the pitch for what became Hawaiian Dick, which I pitched to to Oni Press and Slave Labor, and I think like Devil's Due at the time, because I knew Mike Norton and Tim Seeley and some guys who were working there. And on a whim, I handed the pitch to Eric Stevenson. No, actually to Jim Valentino, who was the publisher at Image, at a convention, which Jim hated. He hated getting pitches at conventions, but he handed it to Eric Stevenson, who was the PR and marketing coordinator. Long story short, Eric responded to it almost immediately. Asked how many issues we wanted to do, what format we wanted to do, black and white or color, and what have you. So Stephen and I did Hawaiian Dick at Image. We did two series within about 3 years. Got ourselves in trouble because we got later and later with it, and that's kind of a long story. But anyway, Steven ended up with 3 Eisner nominations for Best Colorist for like the first 2 series. And the book got optioned, you know, for a film, and just momentum kind of built from there. And once you kind of make an impression, almost no matter what the quality of the book is, if people hear your name a lot and, you know, you get like a movie option and some buzz or what have you, other people will come knocking on the door. So, yeah, so from there, I just kind of, you know, over the past 10 or 15 years, I've done a little bit for just about everybody. Marvel, DC. I did Jeremy Hahn, and I did a book at Oni Press called The Leading Man, which, again, you know, has been optioned and re-optioned over the years, which I just, it all kind of feeds itself. You know, people are willing to listen to you. People come to you, you know, asking if you want to pitch this or that. So anyway, long story short, the way I got to Valiant was, this is actually Killers is the 3rd thing I've done at Valiant. I did a single issue of Bloodshot maybe four or five years ago. And then following that, I did the Savage miniseries, which was a character I created along with Louis LaRosa and Clayton Henry. But Warren Simons, who was the editor-in-chief initially at Valiant, had been an editor at Marvel years ago, like 10, 12 years ago. And I did a short story at Marvel featuring the character Stingray for Warren. And we had kicked around different concepts while he was there. And anyway, some things went here and not much got done. And then Warren left Marvel, and I was working for Image full time for a while. Anyway, out of the blue, Warren called me years later and told me he had taken this job at Valiant and asked me if I wanted to pitch some stuff. And the Bloodshot single issue came out of that. But then sometime later, Savage came out of a conversation we had had years earlier about a concept or an idea I had. And he literally said, why don't we just make this a Valiant character? And so we did. And that's book came out 2 or 3 years ago with just amazing artwork by Louis LaRosa and Clayton Henry with color by Brian Reber, prestige format. And that's in the pro, you know, I know, you know, you guys are Valiant centric, I guess. So, you know, that there's been a lot of editorial turnover the past couple of years. I'd originally kind of talked to Joey Illidge when he was there, and then Carl Bowlers, who edited this book, talking initially about what we could do with Savage next. And then Carl kind of out of the blue asked if I wanted to pitch an idea kind of stemming from Christos's Ninja K series. And I did about a year ago, and here we are. So anyway, but as far as what I've done, most of what I've done, even for other, like even for work for hire, has been maybe a new, like in DC, Tony Harris and I created a book called The Whistling Skull, which we tied into an Elseworlds version of the Justice Society, which was an original concept. I don't know. I mean, like Savage was an original concept within the Valiant universe. This is the same kind of thing. A lot of people don't like creating new characters for companies, so to speak, because they want to hold on to this, the ideas for themselves. But I actually kind of enjoy the possibility of introducing new toys and new characters to an existing framework. So, you know, just to kind of see where they go from there. So anyway, long-winded answer, but that's the basics.
Yeah. So I'm curious, desire to work on some long established characters that you yourself, you know, mentioned that a lot of the ones you've worked on, a lot of the projects have been your own creation. So, you know, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Batman, Superman, I mean, you have ideas in that.
Well, I did well, actually, but the first 2 things I did at DC years ago, there was Dan DiDio had an assistant who moved into editorial named Jan Jones, who is just a good friend and just a fantastic person. But she had initially asked me if I'd be interested in doing DC work. And the first thing they had asked me about doing was a Batman story that would tell the story of how Batman had met Detective Bullock. And then Dan DiDio kind of offhanded said, or we need some material for this Justice Society book we do, the JSA classified or yeah. And of course, I'm like this huge golden age. I love the Justice Society and everything. And so stupidly, I said, oh, I want to tell a Wildcat story instead of a Batman story, which, whatever. The first thing I did was a Wildcat story that I pulled an artist named Ramon Perez in on, which took some doing at the time. But Ramon has since gone on to, he's a phenomenal artist and he's won an Eisner or two. But, and the second thing I did was actually a Superman, three-part Superman story for Superman Confidential. Hmm. This is JSA Classified and Superman Confidential. Yeah, I killed both those books. But I did a three-issue story with Phil Hester and Andy Parks for Superman. So actually the second thing I ever did at DC was a short Superman story. And then I did do a Batman. It was a digital first Legends of the Dark Knight story that Ben Templesmith and I did. Again, kind of had to convince DC that Ben was a guy to use, and it turned into we did a three-part digital story that was then released as a single 30-page issue. I'm not dying to do Batman or Superman, but it's kind of fun to have done those stories using those characters. And then I actually did an Adventures of Superman digital story with Gabriel Rodriguez that was also released as a one, single 30-page. So I've done a little of that here and there. For Marvel, I've literally just done a few short stories, like an Ant-Man story, and the story I did for Warren was with Stingray. I love the kind of oddball, underutilized characters.
Yeah, I love Stingray. He's got such a great...
A lot of it is just because his costume is cool, but yeah, I did this fun... with Lee Weeks was the artist who is... I know, it was... Warren emailed me, and he's like... He goes, do you know who Lee Weeks is? I was like, yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing to me that, this little six-page story was something that Lee ended up drawing. I was at a convention when Savage was coming out. I was at the Baltimore Comic Con with Valiant, and an original art collector came by, and he had like three of the original pages from the Lee Weeks Stingray story that I'd done. And it was kind of amazing to see the original pages. He also had, I think it was the same guy, had a bunch of, before Savage came out, he had bought like a cover in some of Lewis's pages from the book. Which were again, just amazing. I have done that. And also I've done for DC, I did a whole bunch of like special projects is what they call them, which is like, advertising tie-ins.
All right.
So I've written the Justice League like maybe six or seven times, selling Con Edison, Subway sandwiches, the NBA All-Star game, Gatorade, stuff nobody sees. But it's fun. It's like a throwback to those old Hostess cupcake ads they used to have in comics back in the day or whatever. Whatever. I mean, now I'm not, I wouldn't say that I am dying to do, I wouldn't mind doing a long run on an established character just to try to put a spin on it. But most of my tastes with like Marvel and DC and stuff like that run to the weirder and obscure characters. And the truth is, when I was asked to pitch stuff back in the day, I was always pitching stuff that nobody wanted to read. So maybe somebody wants a Black Hawk book or a Paladin book or whatever. Most of the stuff that I've really focused on my energy on has been creator owned stuff at places like Image or Pony Press or.
You might be perfectly suited for this Killers project here at Valiant because, obviously their characters are, I feel like they're pretty well known in comic book circles, maybe not the general public yet. Hopefully, we'll start to change that with the Bloodshot movie. But in comic book circles, people know who Bloodshot is, who Ninjak is, Exo Manowar, these characters. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so you're kind of getting a chance to play in that world with Killers, right? You want to let our listeners kind of know what the elevator pitch, what the story is all about?
Basically it spins, I don't know about the elevator pitch, but I'll, it does spin out of Christos's Ninja K book, which I thought conceptually was just a great idea. Not all the letters work as well when you put them together as Ninja K. I don't know what happens when we get to Ninja P, but I thought the concept itself was really clever and kind of you know, it, as it was intended to do, it really lent kind of new depth to the Ninjak concept. I mean, because let's be honest, a lot of the Valiant characters, the original concepts were just in their rawest essence, kind of awkwardly jammed together to some degree. And Ninjak in particular, which is always an entertaining character, but it's basically, you know, James Bond meets Batman, right. Meets, you know, it's like something, you know, it's like, granted, like if you're 12 or 13 initially, you put the, you know, wow, these are awesome. And, you know, for nostalgic, I mean, I have fond memories of the original series, but I remember when Warren asked me to pitch initially, he sent me, you know, copies of the original books, which I hadn't read in years. And it was kind of like, almost with every concept, you could say, you could see the seeds were there to do a lot of cool things with. And in the case of Ninjak, I really think Christos came up with a pretty inspired concept with this idea of the lineage and, you know, expanding on the ninja program and all that. So in essence, Killers follows some of the forgotten members of the ninja program as they're pulled together in a somewhat common cause. The problem being, none of these characters are inclined to work within a team or together. You know, there's really nothing. They don't really have anything in common beyond their, you know, common service. So there's not like, you know, there's no loyalty to one another. And there's very little loyalty to the program itself. If you've read anything, and again, this isn't stuff you necessarily need to know going in, but if you've read the Ninja K stuff, you understand that with the Acclimation Bureau, there was sort of a lot of these former ninjas feel like they were betrayed by MI6 and the program. So right off the bat, you know, they're not chomping at the bit to get together in a common cause. But what draws them all together is that each of the members of the program that we meet have lost something that's near and dear to them. And that's not a coincidence. There's a reason that these guys have been involved, and it's tied into the fact that each of them has lost something close to them, whether it's, you know, an ability or a person or something larger. And they are convinced that there's a way for them to get what they've lost back on an individual basis. But as the story begins to grow, they're smart enough to realize that as they come under fire from mysterious sources and try to reach this goal, it's going to be easier to get to the goal if they work together than it would be if they're trying to kill each other along the way. So that's kind of the springboard for the story. Actually, the story actually tells how they sort of do come together. And then, you know, it's not a natural partnership, but they do all have the same goal, even if it's on an individual level, if that makes sense. So I don't want to give too much away about what ultimately the final goal is for them, but it does involve the Jonin, which if you've read Ninjak, you'd understand this is the martial arts trainer, he's trained generations of ninja program graduates. And one of the things that the last time we saw this character, one of the things we learned about him was that he had the ability to basically funnel his essence into a unique ability. So what we learn is that each of these ninja program graduates also has the ability to channel their energies into one specific ability that they have focused on, sort of creating super ninjas. You know, I mean, if you want to put it that way. So,
yeah, this the story is really more about the program itself rather than Ninjak or Ninja K, right? Because obviously, Christos built upon what was there before, and I agree with you, it was a brilliant concept to kind of flesh it out. So I feel like Killers is sort of a series that will help flesh out kind of the background and broaden the Valiant universe, which I feel is a really good thing. Because you mentioned you were familiar with Ninjak from before, and then Robert Venditti brought him back in 2012 in the EXO series. But even then, he was a little bit two-dimensional. I really feel like it wasn't until Matt Kent got a hold of him that he started to become a three-dimensional and have more nuance. And then what Christos did in building on that was just brilliant. So had you been following all that stuff all along as kind of the evolution of the character?
I had, in fairness, I kind of jumped in and out of some of the, of just about any, all the new Valiant books. I took an interest when Matt got involved because Matt's part of a kind of a St. Louis, you know, I'm in Kansas City and there's a, Matt's in St. Louis and like there's a sort of geographical brotherhood, you know what I mean? It's like the St. Louis and Kansas City guys kind of, you know, Colin Bunn and Brian Herter over there and, you know, I mentioned Jeremy Hahn earlier and Dennis Hopeless has been here. So it's like, there's this like Midwest kind of connection and you kind of keep tabs on what everybody's doing. And also everybody out here, like St. Louis, even into Chicago and stuff, like even if they're doing work for hire stuff, everybody always has kind of a unique slant or perspective on things. And Matt is a great example of that. I mean, if you followed like all of Matt's work, it's kind of mind boggling, the variety of stuff that he's done really well. And so, yeah, I think I did a panel with Matt when I'd done Savage or whatever, and I took an interest in his Ninjak stuff. And then, and actually I hadn't read Christos' stuff until I think I started talking to Carl, and then I got into the, you know, I read the whole thing. And yeah, it just immediately kind of, it's just, I don't know how to explain it, but like you say, it added depth to, yeah, the character. I think Matt added some depth to the character and then Christos kind of enriched the whole concept, and made the ninja program and the involvement of MI6 and all that more than just, you know, more than just a springboard for the individual, for Colin King. It was more like, yeah, now we've got a whole world we can investigate, that could. And like you say, the thing I like about Killers is that even if this story is basically self-contained, spinning out of that, because of the involvement of Ninjak and the program and everything in MI6 with the broader Valiant universe, there's room for anybody else to expand on what we're doing here, and sort of add a new wrinkle to just about any other Valiant character story. So, which is to say, this is a self-contained story, but at the end of the story, the characters are definitely in a different place that sets them up to impact the Valiant universe more directly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And the word I like to use when talking about Christos's run and this idea of this ninja program is foundational, right? He laid down a foundation, yeah, for everybody that comes after to really kind of broaden, you know, like previously with just Ninjak, yeah, interesting character, much more developed and nuanced, as we said, than the original 90s Ninjak, but you're kind of limited when you're just talking about him in character. Now that he's part of this broader tapestry, there are things that you can build on from there. And it's not to say that Ninjak becomes less important, but he just becomes a more interesting character, I think, because now he's got other characters that as a reader you can relate and compare to, and all of a sudden he gets to play off them, and then it's that interaction that makes it fun, right? And I think it plays into your wheelhouse of liking to create new things, that Christos laid this foundation and now you get to build upon that, right?
Yeah, no, I agree completely. In fact, one of the things that Carl responded to initially is that when I was reading Christos's run and trying to, it was, in all fairness, it wasn't he'd asked me to pitch very broadly, you know, I mean, it was kind of like a general idea of what they might want to do. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a title yet. In fact, I don't think we had a title nailed down until the first issue was written. What I'd done is I kind of, you know, I read, there were moments in Christos's run where they referenced, sometimes not even in the text, but like just visually, previous ninjas. Ninja G, who is kind of our springboard character, was probably the most fully fleshed out, the 70s sort of, you know, she looks kind of like a blaxploitation, you know.
Yeah, Pam Greer, maybe.
Yeah, Pam Greer, sort of, you know, kick-ass broad. I use the term broad in the, you know, in the framework of the 70s. So she was more fully developed than most of them. So it was natural, I think, to use her as a springboard and kind of the linchpin character. But I just kind of looked at some of the visuals and some of the designs for the other ninjas and kind of extrapolated some things from what I assumed they might be all about. And that's what Carl responded to, because some of it kind of matched up with his thinking. So we end up with ninjas from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 90s. There are five, basically there's five of them that are woven throughout the story, starting with G and then J, who's kind of like a model. He's more like, I don't know, he looks like a Shaft or Blade, or, you know, he's kind of a cool leather jacket. I mean, but cooler than you think a leather jacket would look. I mean, he's like, sometimes when I try to describe this stuff, it doesn't sound as cool as it looks. But anyway, the characters all have pretty cool, unique designs as well, and sort of a sensibility to them. And then Fernando, the artist, has just done a great job of sort of bringing them to life within the pages of the book. So,
yeah, I want to talk about Fernando's art in a minute, but I wanted to ask you, when Christos was doing the series, we tell these stories, and it was mostly focused on Ninjak, but every once in a while we'd get these kind of standalone issues that would flesh out one of the other ninjas. And I was always really impressed with what Christos was able to do in terms of making sure that they each were unique and individual, and they didn't seem like kind of like a caricature of you know, here's the
right
African American version of Ninjak. Here's the right, you know, little girl version, or what, you know, whatever particular stereotype. Did you find that to be a challenge as well? Because you mentioned some of these ninjas that are in Killers, we haven't seen before. So you were kind of tasked with the same task that Christos had in making sure that they were their own character and not this kind of, you know, watered down version of Ninjak, so to speak.
No, I think one thing that Christos had kind of done was establish that there wasn't, and it didn't, I mean, it gives you a lot of freedom when you realize that he had kind of established the fact that each ninja was unique, there was clearly no uniform, training or, what I'm saying is very clear that he had communicated the idea that they weren't just retreading the same, you know, character. It wasn't like the Phantom, the character, the Phantom, who's generational, and every 20 years, it's a new Phantom. It was clearly, you know, individual abilities and backgrounds and, you know, what have you. So for me, it was pretty easy to just kind of figure out maybe an era that they had sprung from, and then being like a sort of a history fanatic and pop culture junkie, if I think, okay, well, this character was in London in the swinging 60s, that eliminates any comparison or relationship to what Ninjak became. You know what I mean? It gives me a little different foundation. And then I say, okay, well, you know, let's apply this to an understanding that he was trained by the Jonin. He was used by MI6. How would all of that... Basically, if you just create the character and then think about the influences on his character, you can, you know, the character begins to evolve on their own, which in fairness is just kind of my general philosophy about creating characters. I don't think it's hard for anybody to create any character with any background if you understand where they come from and you have empathy for the character. Once you understand who they are, then the stuff that happens to them in your story helps you develop the character, right? I mean, it's like the character kind of writes itself at that point. So I don't know if that answers your question, but for me it was a basic idea that there wasn't really much similar about these characters except the same goals and basic ninja training. And then when we came up with the idea that they each had their own abilities, it was easy to extrapolate that something within their personality or, you know, something unique about them is why their abilities evolved the way they did. So, yeah, no, that wasn't really tricky. There was never a moment where I think because if you read Christos's run, there's never a moment where you're like, oh, it's Ninjak, you know, Ninjak volume one, Ninjak volume, you know, So
it's not the next Robin the Boy Wonder, you know, right. Young exactly. White teenage kid with dark hair. You know, it's like, yeah.
Now, yeah. Which really, I mean, if you think about it logically, that would almost be the only way to make a program like this work anyway. I mean, you obviously can't hammer everybody into the same mold. And also, Ninjak is such a crazy schizophrenic concept and character himself. I don't know why you would want to repeat that guy.
Yeah, it seems a lot more fun to kind of play with it. And speaking of that, and this may be kind of a situation where I'm asking you to you know, pick between a favorite child, but is there a particular ninja that you created that is kind of standing out for you as kind of your favorite? I really nailed that one.
The most difficult has been Ninja F, the Undisciple. So the idea was that he was around in the late 60s and was sort of like the psychedelic operative for MI6. And of course, at that time, you know, understanding that governments have a long history of experimenting on soldiers and agents with psychoactive drugs and things like this, it seemed natural to me that he's got sort of a psyche. Basically, he can kind of reach into your psyche and pull things out of your head, right? So it all kind of tied into the psychedelic era and mind expansion and all this. So I really wanted him to be... basically, his mind expanded too much, put it that way. So he's not quite all there. So he became kind of a challenge because you've got a character who's sort of disassociated from reality to some degree, but also has to stay involved in reality. So it's kind of a challenge to write this character who was not all there, but had to be there on some level, you know. So he became kind of one of my favorites in that regard because it wasn't quite as easy to just jump into his head as it was the other characters. I'm sure most writers are like this, but for me, the key with any character is just as soon as I understand that character, I don't have to fret over dialogue and this and that because I know what they would say and how they would act. So having this kind of wild card who's sort of in his own head, but out of his own head was more of a challenge. So, in the long run, he kind of became a favorite. I like Ninja G a lot too, just because Christos had alluded to some things about her personal life and who she was and everything. So it was kind of fun to take that next step with her and use her as the character that kind of gets the ball rolling. Blindside is her code name, but those two are probably my two favorites of the crew.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, I find it fascinating that, and I love the idea of giving them each kind of this unique kind of superhuman ability, because, you know, in the past, certainly when Ninjak was introduced, that was part of the shtick, right? Like, he didn't have any power. Right. You know, you mentioned James Bond, Batman, you know, neither one with superhuman abilities. Right. Because one of the things, as a longtime comic fan, the reason I always gravitated toward the team books, because I especially when I was first reading as 5-6 year old, whatever, it's like, man, if I buy this Legion of Superheroes book, I get to discover all these different superpowers, and so I'm looking forward to discovering what each of these ninjas have for this ability. But the other aspect of it, and why I was so excited when I heard you were on this title, I've seen both you and Carl kind of reference the series as more kind of street level in the Valiant universe, but we do have a little bit of superpowers, if you will, with these abilities. But I kind of feel like it's right in your wheelhouse. You mentioned Hawaiian Dick, kind of crime noir. Mm-hmm. So really, is that kind of the genre, or the take you're bringing some of that sort of expertise that you have, so to speak, and bringing this down to the street?
Well, what I would say, less than that, I would say that, and it's actually, it's sort of analogous to Hawaiian Dick in one respect. And it's like, one of the things about, like, Hawaiian Dick is a 50s detective story with Hawaiian supernatural elements, but the supernatural elements are always secondary. Mm-hmm. So my perspective with the supernatural elements was always like, the lead character's name is Bird. It was, so Bird has a case and ghosts and stuff just get in the way sometimes. I mean, or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, they're not generally the thrust of the story. They're just, so in that respect, that's kind of how I approach Killers. It's like they have these powers, but it's not really a book about, the X-Men. You know, I mean, it's the focus isn't on, the powers are things that augment what they're doing, if that makes sense. So there aren't going to be, 12 pages of them using, they're ninjas with ninja training who lean on their abilities to some degree or another. And we may not even, we may barely see the use of those abilities in some cases. And some of their abilities are, are more visual than others. And actually Ninja G, initially, we get almost no indication of her abilities right out of the gate. I'd say that to some degree. It's a little more as grounded as a book about, ninjas who don't age quite as normally as regular people fighting fighting against an ancient martial artist. I wouldn't call it real world, but the idea is more that their powers are something that help them, but they can't really afford to lean on them. And that was something that evolved as the concept evolved too. Just this, we were talking about kind of making it fast paced with a lot of action and just, not getting bogged down in a lot of exposition and, not even focused that much on going too heavily into their backstories, even though we fully understand what they are. Which I like that a lot. I like being able to just kind of jump right into it with the characters. And then as the readers get to know the characters, they really have all the information they need based on their actions, not based on them sitting around in a room and saying, well, when I was a child, I did this and that and this and that or whatever. So some of my favorite writers are, one of my favorite writers in the world was Warren Ellis. And I was always amazed when he did a team book like The Authority, he would introduce a character without going into their backstory, but within about 3 or 4 pages, you kind of knew exactly who that character was, it's like people always talk about the Batman movies, every time there's a new Batman or Spider-Man movie, people are worried they're going to retell that origin. And the reality is, like, if you're a kid and you know who Batman or Spider-Man is, you know who they are. You don't need, you don't need to get bogged down with all these details about their backstory. In that respect, it was kind of like hit the ground running. Oh, they've got powers, but it's never the full gist of the story.
Yeah, and you mentioned Jonin a couple times or referenced him. He started out as kind of the one that was training the ninjas, and we know at some point he went rogue. We don't really know what his motivations are. Obviously we don't want to spoil, but I kind of get the feeling from reading some of the interviews and the solicits that what game he's playing and maybe more importantly why he's playing that game might be part of the story that is in Killers. Is that like accurate? And how do you see him as a character? Because I feel like he has so much potential as a villain. If there's anywhere in the Valiant universe where I feel like they have a lot of room to grow, it's on the villain side. They have really great heroes that are fleshed out. And they have some really great villains, Toya Harada, Master Dark. But they're not there yet in terms of a roster. So having somebody like Jonin, a complex character, added to that kind of rogues gallery of Valiant villains, I think would be a really positive for the universe overall.
No, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I do. His specific motivation in this story is less about his, larger motivation and more about the specific story. But I perceive him as... I don't think he thinks of himself as a bad guy.
Same as Toyo. Those are the best villains.
Right. He's just kind of a megalomaniac. And I think I like the idea of this character. Christos did a lot with it. And then actually talking to Carl and kind of fleshing it out, the idea that he, and Christos actually kind of nailed it when he went into his origin. But I like the idea, because you haven't really seen this a lot. Like, you'll have... you might have an order of monks, and there'll be a rogue who you know, wants to use power for his own. But the whole thing I liked about the Jonin was that he's more like, what? Why would I waste all this power and knowledge on, you know, sitting on a mountaintop and meditating? You know, he's just like, I wouldn't quite call him a sociopath, but he's a narcissist. And so to him, it's illogical that he would, you know, gain all this knowledge and this ability and then not utilize it to make himself happy, basically, right? So, you know, as over the years, as he's grown and as he's sustained himself, and we kind of go into that, his appetites have grown as well, I'll put it that way. So if you're that guy and your appetites are kind of limitless and you're powerful, but you know you can be more powerful, I think that's kind of his base motivation, so to speak. You know, and he's just one of the, he's the guy, he clearly always thinks he's the smartest, you know, the baddest guy in the room. You know what I mean? He's just one of these people who, one of the things I like about him is there's just no self-doubt. You know, he's pretty sure of himself. And we saw that in the last series, you know, he's more concerned about himself than any allies or anything else. So self-preservation is always going to be key. But I do think he's a character that hopefully we, you know, we flesh out a little bit more here and then put him in a position where, he can be a bigger player in the larger universe and a more intriguing and interesting, you know, quote unquote villain. Anybody who is a narcissist who has that much power and who has no empathy for other people is going to be somebody that you have to deal with.
I like that you mentioned that lack of empathy, because what I was struck by in Christos's run, especially when it started and we first learned about the Acclimation Bureau, I remember it being so impactful. I felt like I got punched in the face, but I was like, wait, here's this Jonin, this sensei, this mentor who, you know, typically in those kind of stories, they're the old, wise, very caring master. And all of a sudden, it's like, wait, so if Jonin was that involved with the program, he had to know about the Acclimation Bureau, and it's just seemed such a terrible thing. Right. And that was kind of the first clue we had that Jonin maybe wasn't who we thought he was, because he apparently didn't care that he allowed it to happen.
Well, it's a means to an end. I mean, one of the things in the Ninja G's kind of origin story was Christos alluded to the fact that the Jonin had sort of, you know, used women, or he saw the trainees as his pawns or people that he could manipulate. And then the reason he took an extra interest in her is because she made it very clear very early that she wasn't going to be that. And I kind of like the idea that that wasn't powerful enough to knock him back words and respect the hell out of her, but it was kind of interesting. So he'd take a different approach with her, but you know, when all was said and done, he didn't really care that much. It was just, you know, it was like just a way to see where he could go with this character, you know, with this person. So in some regards in this story, that's, he's taking an interest in these characters for various reasons. Yeah, again, without giving too much away, it kind of leads in that direction. Yeah.
Yeah, and you also mentioned earlier about the Acclimation Bureau and how these ninjas are coming back because they have lost something. It had a lot to do with that, what the program was and what the Acclimation Bureau was. So not in terms of the story, but just personally for you, because I've had this conversation with other Valiant fans and some, I haven't had anybody that said, yeah, I think it was a good thing, but I have talked to a surprising number of Valiant fans who say, well, it was kind of a necessary evil. Like, what were they supposed to do? If they had, you know, there was wartime and then, you know, it needed to be done. Whereas I just see them as evil, the way they manipulated things. So I've just wondered on a personal level, what's your take on the Acclimation Bureau?
Well, I think the Acclimation Bureau would be a natural extension of a sort of basically evil program to begin with. I mean, the whole idea that you're taking basically adolescents or children and sharpening them into knives, you know, I mean, turning them into warriors, which would have to include manipulating their psyches and, you know, changing the entire course of their maturation and, you know, going through, you know, up to going through puberty and stuff, that in its basic essence, that's an evil program. I mean, that's so for me, I think the Acclimation Bureau and one of the kind of clever things about it is, yeah, it is kind of a natural extension of, you know, where that program would think they had to go. I think you, instead of saying the Acclimation Bureau is the bad thing, I'd say, well, the whole program is bad. I mean, you know, it's not, you're not hiring, you know, you're not going out and finding the world's best mercenary and, you know, giving them extra training. You're basically, it's like the Russian, you know, the Soviets in the 60s and 50s and 70s would take children with athletic prowess and then throw them into, you know, gymnastics camp. And that was the only thing you knew in your entire life. So you could go win a gold medal, right? That can't be good. I mean, that completely ignores, you know, free will and what have you. So no, for me, I think it's just more about the notion that the program itself is kind of a, and maybe not as it's written, maybe not at its initiation, but if you read Ninja K and you understand, well, from the beginning, the ninjas they recruited were a problem for them to hold on to, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you've got this program that's got some pretty gray moral areas and you realize right out of the gate, man, it's hard to hold on to these guys, that is, it's actually kind of a logical natural extension of where they might go. So, and of course, the ninja program students have been basically brainwashed. You know, they've been indoctrinated, so they wouldn't see it coming because, you know, they had to have a greater good in mind when they're working they're literally working for the government. So yeah, I can also see why they would have been shocked and devastated when they realized what the Acclimation Bureau was all about. Now, you could also say, I mean, again, this is kind of one of the clever things about that story, is that the Acclimation Bureau at some point was spun so far out of control that it upset, you know, the entire balance of what they were trying to do. So it's a really clever expansion on the original concept.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of a thing, the acclimation, it's such a slippery slope, because where do you draw the line? And I think that's what makes it so insidious.
But I mean, I do think that it's, like I said, I think it's a logical real world. I can see that happening. You know what I mean? It's not like that's a stupid comic book device. It's one of those things where you're like, yeah, that probably is how they would handle things, you know?
Yeah, which part of what makes it so scary. It does seem so
real. But, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I use the Soviet, you know, athletics. That when I was a kid, you know, and you would see these Russians in the Olympics, and you learned that, well, in other communist countries too. But as a kid, you'd think, what? You know, they're literally like put into, you know, track programs or whatever. And of course, then they're pumped full of drugs. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. They're pumped full of drugs and turned into superhumans. And you see these, you know, these weightlifting women who look like they're, you know, supervillains, because they were, basically. It happens in real life along those lines. So,
yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the art on the book. I'm not familiar with Fernando Dagnino. Is that how you say his last name?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with his work, and Valiant often does this. They find great kind of unknown artists, at least unknown to me. I was blown away. Very kinetic style, a lot of detail. Is this the first time you were exposed to Fernando's work as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, which is rare. I mean, with Savage, I was aware of what Lewis could do and had done, and Clayton Henry as well, obviously. But no, I hadn't. I don't think I had seen Fernando's work. Sometimes, though, people will show me artists, and I'll think it's amazing, and I'll realize I've been following them on Instagram or what have you. But I think Fernando had done some American comics and kind of stepped away for a little while. He's coming back. But yeah, very much the same way. There's another writer who's doing something for Valiant in the future, and same kind of thing. We were talking about artists, and he mentioned this artist I wasn't real familiar with, and then sent me some work, and it's just, you know, it's amazing how, it's not just amazing how they find artists that are well suited to the projects with, like you say, you know, this kinetic style and everything. It's that for the most part, they fit right in with it's not a house style, but they fit side by side with the other things that are going on at Valiant. You know, it's not jarring for a Valiant fan to see their art compared to what they're used to seeing. So, Carl sent me quite a bit of, you know, a portfolio of stuff that he had done, and I was just like, wow, he can work in a variety, kind of subtle things with his style. That, you know, he'll do some tones. He's very talented guy, and he really excels at both the action and the kind of quieter character moments as well. So it's been a lot of fun seeing what he can do.
Now, did you two work together to design the new characters that we hadn't seen before?
No, it was kind of a four-part effort. Carl and I talked about some of the characters. Editorial talked about it. Fernando, and then they actually had, and I wish I could tell you who it was right now. But they actually had a couple different people contribute designs initially before they settled on, I'm blanking on who exactly did, but they had someone come in basically and do sort of they're almost like color coded, you know what I mean? They each have their own fashion styles on top of the basic design. So they had a separate designer do that. And then Fernando, ran with that. And then, you know, I've been encouraged to come up with suggestions for, you know, for costumes or wear that might match what the designs look like. So it's been, to a large degree, it's been, I don't want to say a committee effort, but it's been a group effort to a large degree, kind of pulling everything together. Because in all honesty, the approved pitch was very basic. It was kind of like an open shell. I mean, it was like there was a lot of room to put stuff into it, which I think was kind of one of the reasons Carl responded to it. It was an opportunity for us to kind of build as we went along. So it's been fun though, watching it come together.
Yeah, I feel like not only is Fernando's art so well suited for this particular story, but kind of suited for the style of story that you like to tell from the work I've read. So I really would look forward to you doing more things with him in the future.
I'd be more than up for that. Yeah. I'd love to. Been focused on this right now, but since the two main things I've done at Valiant have been sort of original concepts based on, well, Savage was more original than not, but I mean, it was, you know, we did tie obviously existing elements of the Valiant universe into it, but I'd love to be able to do more with those characters or, you know, something more directly with some of the more established characters. And obviously, yeah, if Fernando's on board, that'd be great too.
Now, you mentioned tying in. How much is Killers going to tie into what's going on in the overall Valiant universe? We know it's very new reader friendly and, you know, building on what Christos did. One of the things Valiant fans really like is kind of the tight continuity. So, you know, maybe you don't necessarily need to read the other stuff, but if you are reading it, will there be some payoff? Will you see some familiar things?
For this book, more or less, this book is the only continuity it really aligns with is what had happened previously in Ninjak, and understanding that, you know, pretty shortly here they're going to jump kind of back into Ninjak and some more expanded stuff. So I think it's more of a springboard within the existing framework, if that makes any sense. But I just think that the nature of what had been established in Ninjak or Ninja K prior to this, you know, it gives this book kind of its life's blood, and just that alone creates an opportunity for it to kind of seep into the larger continuity, if that makes any sense.
So as a Valiant reader and a Ninjak, huge Ninjak fan, he's probably my second favorite Valiant character after Bloodshot. This is a must read for me because, you know, it really is kind of the bridge between Christos's Ninja K and the Ninjak series, the next Ninjak series, I guess you would say.
Right. Yeah. And then there's no way, you know, there's no way to move forward with Ninjak without understanding these guys are out there. You know what I mean? So yeah, definitely. It's like a pebble in the shoe, I guess. It's, you know, it's there. So there's, you know, there's no way they won't have some impact on the larger Valiant story.
Well, if someone's a new reader, you know, we've mentioned several times about how it's very new reader friendly. You don't have to have any prior knowledge of things that have gone on. But if somebody did want to have some knowledge, is there anything other than what we've already talked about that you would want a new reader to know going?
Not really. I mean, really, the only, you know, and we lay it out pretty quickly and pretty easily in the book, but I would say the real key is just a basic knowledge of the Ninja program is really all you would need. And I think we do lay that out as the book goes on. I think if you read Ninja K, you know, it'll enrich this reading just because, especially if you've read The Origin of Ninja G and you kind of understand the Acclimation Bureau, you might have an extra level of appreciation for the book. But beyond that, I think it works pretty well for somebody to just walk into. And there may be things alluded to or characters that you want to, you know, the Jonah being a good example, that you want to investigate more deeply, in which case, you know, Valiant makes it very easy to jump back and rediscover what's gone on previously. So, hopefully new readers or even Valiant readers who aren't Ninjak fans can walk into it and figure out what's going on and enjoy it on that level.
Yeah, I think I didn't realize how closely Killers was going to tie into the Acclimation Bureau and the things that Christos had done. And I just adore that series. And so when I read the first issue and I saw how closely it tied in, I was just over the moon. So congratulations on a great first issue. I can't wait to read more. But I want to give you the chance. Anything else that you want to share? Any other upcoming projects or anything at all that you want to share with the listeners?
Probably not yet. I've got a handful. I've been sort of focused on, actually this came up in the middle of working on a handful of new creator owned things for different people that should be announced and released in the next year and a half. Actually one project is completely finished, but I know it won't be out till next spring. You know, if you're curious what I'm up to, you can always follow me on Twitter. And now and then I'll mention what I'm working on. But beyond that, yeah, this is the thing that's up next. As new things come up, I'll, you know, if anybody pays any attention to me, I'm sure I'll wear them out.
Right on. Well, I'll put a link to Clay's Twitter in the show notes, everybody. So if you want to know what he's up to when he can announce those projects, just go and click on the link there and you'll be able to follow them. So Killers comes out July 31st, Wednesday, July 31st.
Yeah, I think it's July.
So can't get here soon enough. As I said, congratulations on the first issue. It's absolutely spectacular. And I know I will be reaching out to let you know my thoughts. And hopefully we'll have you back on when the whole story is out. And maybe sure. The trade's about to drop and we can talk a little more spoilery about kind of what your thought process was as the story unfolded and such. It'd be great to have you back on.
Sounds great, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, best of luck. Hope sales-wise the book does really well. And all you Valiant fans, I know there's a lot of Ninjak fans out there. Trust me, you're really going to want to pick this up because it picks up kind of right where the Ninja K series from Christos left off. So, again, Clay, thanks so much for your time, and look forward to reading the rest of the story.
Thanks, man. I greatly appreciate it.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.